The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Wednesday, the 14th of July, 2021. On the podcast today, Kyle Friel, Executive Chairman of Open Orphan, discusses the plethora of news they've released today, including why he's made a substantial purchase of shares for himself. Plus, John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel, talks about inflation, the dollar strengthening, and Anglo-Asian mining, strategic minerals, Bushveld Minerals, and Mustang Energy. Also, Glenn Goodman, former ITV News business correspondent and now the author of The Crypto Trader, covers this week's Bitcoin support and resistance levels, plus the Mets' record crypto haul. And again, you know, we argue a lot. We do that a lot every day, every week of the podcast. Just he's a trader. I'm more of an investor, and that's where the differences lie. And at the end of the podcast, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most read RNSs. You can check out both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk. We'll also see lots of the content. In fact, there's an article there on Challenger Energy from Fran. There's Zach Mears bulletin boards. He covers some popular companies charts there. Avacta, Omega, Open Orphan, and Extract Resources. There's an article on Alien Metals. There's an article there on Intelligent Ultrasound. And also, don't forget, COVID-19 Index, biggest rise of the day is Symphony Environmental Technologies, up 13% to 21.5. Biggest fall of the day is Cromec Group, down 5% to 15.3. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Cahill Friel, Executive Chairman of Open Orphan, ORPH. Cahill, thanks for joining me.
Justin, pleasure having you.
Yeah, got some news out, some big news, contracts announced, and we'll talk about that. But as always, Kyle, it's always changing, evolving. So for people just joining the story, could you just refresh their memory as to what Open Orphan's about, please?
Yeah, Justin, thank you very much. Yeah, Open Orphan is basically the world's largest and leading tester, clinical trial tester of vaccines, antivirals. We're very profitable. We're London-based, and we're having a really good time. And we've got particularly exciting plans because we're coming out of this pandemic. Infectious diseases will be the single biggest market, and we're right front and central to test all these new products, influenza, COVID, malaria, strep pneumococcus, RSV, all of that. And that's our bread and butter. So really exciting times for us.
Yeah, excellent stuff. Okay, tell me more about these contracts we announced this morning, Kyle, if you could.
Yeah, look, we've been working on contracts. Some of them take a bit longer. I know some of our investors are getting restless where the hell are the contracts. So look, the first one is a really exciting American leading biotech. And it's a whole new departure for us. It's an influenza HRV, which is fabulous because that indication where the world of infectious disease is going, that is a fabulous contract. We haven't put contract size on because it's quite sensitive given it's a unique trial, but we think we'll do a bunch more of these this year. Influenza is the one that people are worried about these days. So COVID, there's a cure. Influenza's coming back. And then the second one, I know some of our folks were getting a bit worried about our COVID trials up in the Royal Free. Well, guess what? You'll see clearly an extension of that trial, more work ongoing. So, yeah, COVID, as I say, hasn't gone away, and we're busy in the COVID space as well. And that's really exciting to have an extension to that particular piece of work as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, to be honest, COVID and the flu are never going away. There'll always have variants of that, so they'll always have to have new, updated vaccines of different variants. So, okay, so do you know what? Of late, the small cap and micro cap space has had a bit of a sell-off, and it is one of those things that investors, I think, is largely emotional. I keep saying to people, if you're invested in, you know, improving, growing companies, hold on. And stats prove it out all the time. Timing the market beats trying to time the market. Now, you know, Open Orphan hasn't been excluded from the sell-off. The share price has gone down a bit there. We'll talk about that in a bit, but you've made substantial share purchase. Can you tell me more about that, Cahill?
Yeah, just, and again, like sometimes our investors open off and we've been moving very fast. As you and I first talked just over 2 years ago when our share price was 5.7p, we've had a great run. Yeah, look, the share price has come back, and I've been saying now for a month I was going to increase my stake. I have a major part of my net worth. So yeah, I bought £300,000, not euros, pounds worth. That's two times my annual salary. It's going to be locked up for a few more years. I just think it's a fabulous buying opportunity. I had hoped to buy two, 3 weeks ago, the publication of annual accounts, but I couldn't while these two contracts were uncompleted. Mm-hmm. Now the contracts are completed, I'm free from insider information. And I just think, yeah, it's a fabulous buying opportunity at the moment. I think, as you say, small cap companies, people do panic, usually at the wrong time. I think this is not a time to panic. Bear with us, and I think in the weeks and months ahead, you'll see Open Orphan in particularly good shape.
Yeah. And I mean, this personal drop off here in the SP, is it got anything to do with, you know, why is it happening? Do you think, apart from general market sort of malaise over the summer, it happens all the time? But is it something people are doing, selling Open Orphan to buy Pullbeg?
Absolutely. Look, the good part of it, we're delivering. We have spun off our first asset. It is IPOing imminently, within a week or two. We've given a very major dividend species. So Open Orphan has gone ex-dividend. So when you pay out a dividend, whether it's 10 or 15 or 20%, you expect the share price to drop by the according amount. Mm-hmm. And yet our share price dropped. Now, it overreacted a bit because we are ex-dividend, but more importantly, I think it looks like some of our investors, we really want to double or triple the Pullbeg share price upon a short period in time, make it a very viable investment. But some of our investors are selling Open Orphan to free up cash to go into the market, because the Pullbeg, we haven't really gone to any retail. We've given all Open Orphan shareholders a free stake in it. They are locked up for 9 months. So yeah, there has been an arbitrage. Unfortunately, these things happen. People are selling Open Orphan to free up cash to buy Pullbeg. My advice was sit tight. You have free shares in Pullbeg. We will really drive them. And sit back, and your investors now have two horses in the race. Keep the Open Orphan out front and coming up fast behind Pullbeg.
Yeah, absolutely. I like that. Cool. You mentioned just earlier, you know, profitable. Can you confirm that if H1 was profitable?
Yeah, just a good point. I think that as well, because we've a lot of moving parts. Some investors were really, are you guys profitable? Absolutely. I can absolutely convince, and you've seen in our Nomad statement in my share purchase RNS, we can absolutely confirm that H1 was very substantial, even that profitable. So, and we're really on track on everything to have a very profitable year. So we're in perfectly good shape. So we're really happy.
So, I was going to ask whether you're looking forward to, you know, you're bullish for the rest of the year, but I'm assuming you are.
Yeah, look, really bullish. I say, no, we've done the first spin-off. We have said we've got three more spin-offs. The one to watch, it's like a bit of a horse race. It's limbering up in the stables, is the Disease in Motion. That will be spun off in the autumn time. And we would like to see that also going into public company. And then it's a bit like I'm going to have to get the baseball bat out and get our friends in the Immutex moved along and Prep Pharma moved along. And sometimes with small cap pharma, I say a man has to do everything himself, and it looks like, but they will. We've made a commitment by Christmas, all four non-cores will be spun off and handed back to our shareholders in a dividend species. And a nice way to end up Christmas, it would be, I'm now a very large shareholder, I haven't bought more shares. We're building the cash up, so a lovely little cash dividend before Christmas would be a nice way to end the year, on top of having done four dividend species.
Marvellous stuff. Okay. Come on, let's give it three reasons then. If someone's listening right now and liking the sound of what you're doing here, and maybe they want to take advantage of that dip, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add Open Orphan to their watch list, please.
Yeah, what I would say, Justin, the big one, our share price has come back. I think it's a fabulous buying opportunity. I bought. Second, we have a bunch more spin-outs today. Every holds Open Orphan, have three shares in the second public company. There's no reason why we can't do that a second, a third, and a fourth time between now and Christmas. And finally, I think, look, the management team, we're very much invested. We're increasing our stake. We're only in year two, complete year two, going to year three. I think there's not many AIM companies that have the management team and founders increasing their stake in year three. So we're not going away. We've got a lot done, and say a lot more to do, and a really, really exciting months ahead of us.
Marvellous stuff. It's always good to chat to you, Kyle. And like you say, lots of exciting months ahead, so no doubt we'll be catching up then. Thanks very much. Speak soon.
Justin's pleasure. Thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel. All right, John?
Yes, good. Thank you.
Let's talk about the inflation issue that's rearing its head and people are talking about, and US dollar and all that stuff. What's happening here?
Yeah, US inflation ahead of forecasts, and that's caused the dollar to strengthen. Reason for the strengthening is because every time the dollar strengthens, it suggests to the market that the Federal Reserve may need to tighten its ultra-easy monetary policy, and maybe even bring in slightly higher interest rates ahead of the 2023 sort of limit that they have indicated to the market. So as soon as the US start to raise interest rates, or as soon as they indicate a raising interest rates sooner than expected, then the dollar will strengthen more. So people, you know, the market's just anticipating that to some degree. Higher interest rates in the States are being driven by higher oil prices, also by higher used car prices, because it's a 6 month lead time to buy a new car these days. In fact, longer than that in many cases because of the chip shortage. But having said that, I think, what we're seeing, we should be seeing more reshoring of industry into the US from China, particularly with the logistical issues between China and the US and the very high cost of shipping now. So low value products are finding it difficult to find the margins for those shipping costs. Mm-hmm. So the world is changing one way or another. And at the same time, we've got a situation in China where things are slowed down a little bit. The Chinese have recently they said they're going to reduce the banking reserve requirement ratio, the RRR, as they like to call it. And that was an interesting move, because that suggests that they're trying to sort of help small and medium-sized enterprises in China. They talked about this before. They talked about the damage that higher commodity prices were doing to these small and medium companies, where margins are often quite low, and where these companies are struggling. And I think they're struggling on a number of levels, logistical levels, high transport costs, and the higher input prices from commodities. Yeah. So Chinese government trying to help that. I think also they're trying to keep their growth rate on track. China is not slowing down for anyone, and they will stimulate parts of the market in order to ensure that.
Yeah, but it's essentially, when the dollar strengthens, that's bad for commodities, really. It's not good for commodities, is it?
It almost always causes metals prices to tick back. What is interesting is that actually copper, nickel, tin prices are all relatively strong. So I think we're in a situation where the demand for these metals, particularly from electric vehicles, and we've seen some interesting stats on electric vehicle sales and vehicle sales in China in general looking very good, with electric vehicle sales are just knocking the ball out of the park at the moment. Whenever you see any new stats, they are very, very strong. They're right at the top end of anyone's bullish forecasts. And that's the way the world is going. I personally think that used car prices are high in the US and elsewhere around the world, because why buy a new gasoline or diesel vehicle when you know that policymakers are going to force you to go electric? And I got my guys to do a list of vehicles yesterday on for new electric vehicles, the new models coming through. And there are hundreds of them. I mean, there's $397 billion of investment being planned by the major major automotive companies, and the number of models, I mean, I could read you the list, but there's many of them. 15 from Toyota, 70 from Volkswagen, 23 from Hyundai. That's just the first three. These are all coming in, most of them before 2025. With Volkswagen, there's 70 new models before 2029, but there'll be many more on the way. Interesting, there was a video of somebody driving a BMW i3, which is the electric sports car, through a flooded London road yesterday. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that was good. First, good that the car was going, and second, that the driver didn't get electrocuted inside, given that the water level seemed to be halfway up the car doors.
Yeah, I'm sure they test for that, but I wouldn't feel safe myself going having that amount of electric running through the car while I'm sitting inside it. But yeah, do you know what? I was listening to a lady who has she's in the car industry, and she was saying that if Teslas have a crash, then it's not very clear-cut. Basically, the claims would be quite big because you have to go to a special Tesla dealer and all this stuff, and it's a lot more complicated than a normal crash in a car. And so the premiums will have to be quite high. I don't know if that's true, but and in fact, they said the premiums will get higher because at the moment they're not reflecting the cost of repair, which are quite high compared to normal cars. So it's very interesting that. But I think there's a lot of hidden costs at the moment. But okay, let's go into some individual company news. Anglo-Asian, some news out. What's happening with them? AAZ?
Yeah, AAZ. Second quarter production update. Good results there. They produced 12,000 ounces of gold in the second quarter, in fact, 12,300 ounces, higher than second quarter a year ago. Looking good. Also a bit more copper as well, and they doubled their silver output actually. So they must be in a part of the mine where there's richer silver grades. So Anglo-Asian looking like a good company. They pay a sensible dividend there. And the sales of gold bullion, 13,900 ounces, at an average price of $1,808 an ounce. So good money coming in. Mm-hmm. Another $9 million in revenues from copper concentrates. And they got $36.6 million in cash. So what's not to like about this company?
Yeah, cool. Next one, Strategic Minerals. Now, they announced a license, or was it a temporary license, a conditional license, recently. I think it was Monday, and the share price dipped. And I thought, what's the problem there? Why did it dip? What was the news here?
Well, they've got a provisional license. That's not so unusual. It means that they've just got to do a bit more work to satisfy the conditions for that license, and it tells you that there's a license coming, and there's just a bit more work to do. Hopefully that won't take them too long. We'll need to talk to them a bit more about what the conditions are. But it's a small copper project. It's a nice thing to have at this stage, and it's not going to cost them anything much in terms of capital development costs. So I think that's looking quite nice. I'm not sure why.
I think I spot the issue here. They said there's a conditional approval from the Department of Energy and Mines for its program for the environmental protection and rehabilitation. As part of the approval, the DEM, which is the Department of Energy and Mines, required a deposit of $3.7 million, and Native Vegetation Fund contribution via significant environment. They'll also pay $81,000. That's US. I assume that's not much, but I think it's at $3.7 million security deposit. So maybe that's an issue, is it?
Presumably they'll borrow that money from somewhere because it'll lodge that.
The debt, they said here, they're going to just debt-style funding for the project. There's been encouraging meetings. So maybe that's the uncertainty.
This is a company that doesn't like to issue equity. Mm-hmm. It runs a pretty tight ship. It has money coming in from their magnetite sales in New Mexico in the United States. Magnetite prices are still very high because they follow iron ore to some degree. They have the Redmore project as well down in Cornwall. The value of that project has gone up quite a lot in terms of the potential to make for the economics of that, because tin prices have gone up. So, it's a tin copper tungsten project. So that's looking much more prospective at this point in time.
Yeah, cool. And sort of related in some way, management overlap here. A company called Mustang, MUST is ticker. Now, they released an RNS today, and it was based on a release from Bushveld Minerals and something else. So what's the connection? Because I know you like Bushveld, and what's the connection here between Mustang and Bushveld? I don't know anything about the company, really.
Yeah, I do like Bushveld. It's I mean, it's been a bit frustrating over the last couple of years, and the shares are not a demanding level. There seems to be some legal action from a group called Garnet Commerce Limited, and I had a look around to see this company, and it's listed on the Alberta Corporations website, which must mean it's listed in Alberta in Canada, and it's been listed as liable for dissolution since December 2019. So they must have had some kind of joint venture with Enerox or one of Enerox's subsidiaries. We don't know that. I don't know the details of this yet, but they're alleging that that there's a breach of their joint venture agreement with Enerox Holdings Limited. So they've alleged this against VRFB Holdings, which is a business that's been set up by in conjunction with Bushveld Energy, which of course is owned by Bushveld Minerals. Bushveld Energy own an interest of 25.25% in Enerox. So, look, I suspect, I don't know how they're going to get any money out of Enerox or Bushveld Energy or VRFB Holdings. I think they're just going to cause a bit of trouble and hope that they get paid to go away, because clearly these people are not able to invest in the joint venture themselves by the looks of things. I say clearly, it's not necessarily clear, but a company that lists itself as that is listed as liable for dissolution doesn't inspire much confidence. Mm. I don't think this has any real impact on Bushveld Minerals myself. But it's a distracting press release.
Yeah. Marvellous stuff. And what's the chart of Bushveld looking like at the moment? Oh, it's testing those lows, isn't it? Of, the sort of 11, 12 pence lows there. So that could be good support, you know. Maybe a little bit more to go, but could be good support.
Well, vanadium prices have been going stronger, not just in China, but around the world. Prices in the US and Europe have pretty much caught up with prices in China. The price in China is always a bit ahead because of the the 13% VAT, which is effectively a tariff that they charge on vanadium imports. I actually see next year looking really good for Bushveld. This year is a tough year, there's no doubt about that, following on from last year, and they had big maintenance program in the first quarter, and then a few issues on the restart of the plant of Vermetco up following that maintenance closure. But I think the second half will be certainly much stronger than the first half, and next year is looking good.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous stuff. John, thanks for that, fella, and we'll speak to you next week.
Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Glenn Goodman. He's the author of The Crypto Trader. And I've got to say, the book saved my life. Really did, Glenn. Just put that on there. Just don't put the rest of it on. What happened is I had my coffee on it. I spilled it and it soaked up a good chunk of that. And that would have gone on my Mac. So I got to say thank you, Glenn. And also inside, there's some wonderful trading advice, apparently. So, as a coaster,
but you wouldn't be able to see that because it's all just covered in coffee.
It spilled a little bit. It's fine. But I'd say, you know, it's not just a crypto book. It's not just about trading crypto. It's also a handy coaster.
Yeah, many people have said this.
Do you want me to put that review on there? Probably the best coaster I've had. Do you know what? It's the most consistent coffee coaster I've had for a long time. Honestly, normally the ones I've used previously haven't lasted.
As long as you didn't get coffee on the picture of my face that's on the book.
No,
that's the most important part.
There is a big coffee. Turn it around slowly because I've got coffee on there now. I turn it around slowly and there's literally a coffee stain, right? And it goes, it's almost like a bit of a face mask, but it looks like it's been pulled to the side a bit. But the face mask goes up in between your eyebrows and doesn't quite fit. It fits over your nose and part of your mouth. But it looks a bit phallic, actually, that coffee stain.
You just like drizzle a little bit more coffee on so that I get an all over tan. That would
Do you know what I've done now? I've actually wet my finger and I've cleaned your face up, Glenn. There we are.
Get your dirty finger off me.
just got a bit of coffee stain on your neck at all. Okay, let's talk about, first of all, the price of Bitcoin, because it's been consistent a little bit. It's rallying to sort of levels where there's resistance, coming back a little bit. I did say, I tweeted out this way, I said, so I've got a downward channel in the RSI. Now, it's quite funny, the RSI, because downward channels, I don't know if you... I don't really hold them too much. I prefer strict sort of horizontal, you know, resistance and support levels. A bit stronger, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, but, same
on,
here.
Yeah, on the RSI, I mean, this the RSI started having higher lows way before the price peaked. It started doing it at like 40,000. And yet the next peak, the RSI came down, didn't quite peak, and then came down again. And then all of a sudden, the RSI didn't go above 70, and it dipped below 50. I thought, uh-oh, that's where weakness came in. But it rallied again, but the RSI again didn't reach a new high. And then all of a sudden, it really bottled down below 50. Now, if you look at the downward channel on that, this week, Bitcoin tested that downward channel, then bounced off it, and now it's gone back down below the 50. So it's still weakness there. Now, it'd be interesting to see whether it's going to go below that 30, 31 level, because that seems strong resistance. But... if it does, what do you think? Do people just start selling, or?
I think the main resistance is still where it's been since January, actually.
You know, support with or resistance?
Sorry, support, yeah. Yes. The main support level has been, you know, obviously we didn't know it would be a support level back in January because we hadn't even hit the highs for the year. It was the... You know, if you're going to use this head and shoulders pattern analogy, which I think is very appropriate in this case, then it formed the kind of left shoulder in January. Then we had the head where the price shot right up in March, April, reached its highs. And that's sort of roundabout where I sold my holdings just after that, sort of fairly near the top. And then it came back down again and formed this second shoulder of the metaphorical head and shoulders. And it's formed it at the perfect level because it's the exact same level as we were at back in January. And the support line is at about 28,500 to 29,000. That's the really key level to watch. I mean, if you look at the price right now, you can see it sort of edging its way back down there towards 32,000 and could possibly... It could possibly meander its way downwards through 31,000 and 30,000 that you were just talking about. I think the really key level is lower than that. It's about 28,500. And, well, that's for Bitcoin. A lot of the other cryptos are looking even weaker. Some of them are just, you know, they've just been relentlessly weak for a few months now. But they are forming these kind of diagonal resistance lines. Have you seen this on some of them? Dogecoin, the famous Elon Musk's little Dogecoin, for example. If you ever look down, it's very easy to just draw a diagonal line down from May's or near May's highs all the way down to where we are now. And when you get such a defined line as that, that is something that is very tempting for traders to try to break through. So we could see a sharp spike upwards. But the problem with those diagonal lines, as you and I know, is that quite often when you get a breakout through one of those diagonal lines, it's only a temporary phenomenon. Sometimes it leads to a larger kind of rally that goes on and on for weeks and weeks, but fairly often it's just a little temporary blip and then the price heads back down again. And that's what worries me, is that from a sort of classical charting perspective, it's all pretty negative. Basically, we've got horizontal support lines now on almost every crypto, or certainly very many of them, and those lines are just begging to be broken on the downside.
Yeah. I do think we need this level of boredom, like you say, you know, if you said before, when it's not the big sell days that when everyone sort of gets out, because everyone expects a bounce. So there's a lot of volume on those days, people expecting to make a bit of money on the bounce trade, you know. It's when it goes sideways pretty much and doesn't give you any room for trading. It's in a tight range, gets boring, maybe even grinds lower with no big rises. And then all of a sudden, just you know, a bit of capitulation then, because people say, oh, I'm going to put my money elsewhere because just grinding lower. And people don't like to hold when it's grinding low, do they? They don't see it as an investment, see it as a trade, and they're losing on the trade.
Exactly. Look, just for a quick fractal analogy, you know, because markets patterns tend to repeat themselves over time and across different asset classes, it's the human psychology that causes these particular patterns to repeat again and again. And a pattern that we saw in late 2018, sort of just, first of all, we had the period that was analogous to where we are now, where it's just heading down and down, but it has these kind of brief blips upwards before then going even lower, and then another blip upwards. But then you had a period of boredom like the one that you're talking about, where people started losing interest, and then a final plunge that was kind of like the final nail in the coffin for crypto. Yeah. It was the one where all the newspapers started. This is in late 2018, a big plunge in all the newspapers saying, you know, that's it, Bitcoin is finished, it will probably never come back, that kind of thing.
That's a lot of analysts, generally, same, yeah, same.
And that's the bottom, obviously, yeah.
That is the best time to invest. Fear in the markets, fear is your friend. I remember going, you know, and at the time when everyone's, you know, really scared, it's going to go, that is the best time. You pick up the best prices then, because everyone's just selling and you are the opposite trade there. You'll have volatility, of course, but if you're not checking too much in, that you're going to lose your house and the farm, and you're not overexposed, you're not leveraged, that's a time to start nibbling away, I think, in any investment.
Well,
you know?
I mean, you know that I strategize in a slightly different way than you,
but
with trends, but that I'm not that different in the sense that, you know, back then in late 2018 when the price plunged right down there, obviously the human part of me was tempted, you know, oh, I should be buying right now, but the kind of sensible trader part of me that watches the trends said, no, I better wait until there are the early signs of a turnaround in the market. And that's exactly what I did. And I've showed this in when I've spoken at seminars and so on. I've showed it on a screen, how I waited throughout late 2018 and early 2019 as the price was basically bumping along the bottom, but it was forming a nice resistance line. It was forming a nice kind of little upward sloping triangle, ascending triangle. So with a flat top surface. So, you know, the triangle bit is neither here nor there. The important part, as you and I know, is the resistance line. It formed a strong horizontal resistance line, which you can see if you look at a chart now, between November 2018 and April 2019. So there was almost 6 months of not much happening. I was sitting on my hands waiting to buy. But as soon as it broke through that resistance line, I became interested and I became a buyer because, and indeed, it didn't stop. The price broke through that level and it didn't even retest that level. It didn't even go back down to test it again. It just shot straight up and then carried on going up and up and up and up for about 3 months. And it quadrupled in price over that time. So, you know, you can't. You know, I suppose what I'm saying is, yeah,
right,
you know, from you, I'm saying that from your sort of investing perspective, you like to nibble when you see the bottom. From my kind of trading perspective, my trend trading perspective, I always take the view that you never know for sure where the bottom is. Yeah, a lot of signs pointed
I don't say it's the bottom. I say when there's, and I often say this to new investors who want to get in, I said, whenever you see, you know, headlines on the main, you know, stream news, like 6 o'clock news or 10 o'clock news, what time is the news these days? It's rolling news, but I mean on the BBC One,
obviously 10, one there, I think, yeah.
Yeah, 10. When you see stock markets have lost billions, have been wiped off the face value of companies, give it 3 days, and then maybe buy a fund, you know, a decent fund, and you'll do well. You know, every time you see one of those, and literally check a load in it, a decent diversified fund, it's low cost. If you want it, you know, if you want to get better returns and just chuck it in the bank, get a fund in those times and then wait for the next correction and do it again. Wait until it helps. And if you top the, you're basically getting a better price than most of the market in those times, because most investors are, you know, who have been averaging up or being buying at the highs are now worried and selling at the lows. So you're just buying the shares off them. But as an investor, this is what I think. If I'm investing in a business I know very well and it's doing better, and then you have a general market sell-off, like we're having at the moment with small caps, it's hard work. We've been grinding sort of lower for like,
yeah,
2 months now, pretty much. I think, I mean, I'm fully invested anyway, but I think, how much of this business can I own? That's what I think.
Yeah, but doesn't it worry you that...
Not at all.
You know, doesn't it worry you that you're nibbling at relatively small dips? I mean, I agree with you that, you know, if you get a proper market plunge, the sort of once in a decade like 2008, you know, then obviously at the bottom of that... I mean, I started buying in March 2009, which was you know, almost, it was just past the bottom. It was when the trend started turning upwards. But, you know, from an investing point of view, investing in small caps, that again would be the perfect time to buy. But what worries me, I suppose, is that the little dips that we're getting right now in small caps and so on, you know, we've gone up so far in the last decade or so, and valuations in general, though valuations in general are so overstretched that it's certainly not out of the question that we could have the big one at some point.
I'm never looking in general. I'm looking at specific stocks, and I always look at the valuations of them and, you know, what they can be valued at going forward, reasonable sort of, you know, projections. So, and I always try and get a bargain. And you can get bargain. I haven't made any trade for the last month in anything. And and even then was sort of just moving stuff around a bit. But
because the bargains are few and far between. I guess that's why you're...
But they're always out there. You always find some decent bargains in small caps. I mean, but I found whenever, you know, the world is saying the media is saying the world's going to hell in a handcart, then that's the time to get in. It really is. I mean, because you know full well, the stock market's been through world wars, pandemics, you know, bank crashes, dot-com crashes, and it's always end up higher. And so, just looking at the longer term view, that's it's always survived. It's always thrived, and those are buying opportunities. And in fact, if you look at any of the best investors, they say the same. They are buying opportunities. Full stop. And in fact,
hang on.
I'm saying, looking at your tweet as well. Those guys were all wrong. They were buying opportunities. That tweet you tweeted out the day. Where were they? They're all saying this will be the worst crash ever. George Soros and all no one saw that rally happening. But I started topping up in a fund I had on that. I didn't have much cash, but I mean, I was topping it. No, I did have cash, and I was topping up in a fund. On those days, it was going down every day. I was topping up in the fund, and it bounced back nicely, that fund. And I just think any massive sell-off like that, it's a buying opportunity longer term.
The 2021, I guess, was severe enough to kind of count in the way that you're talking about. But it still took us...
I guess it's severe enough.
It was just a blip, though.
Hang on. That was the fastest sell-off in history.
Yeah, I know, but it was still just a blip.
Yeah, in longer term, exactly. That's my argument. Stock markets go up over time. If you just scroll out and look at years and decades, they're all little blips.
All right, hold on. I'm looking at a weekly chart right now of the S&P 500, and we are so incredibly overstretched.
Oh, the S&P is
historically.
I don't look at the S&P. I don't know.
But here's the thing: is that even with the crash, even during the crash in 2020, which was a huge crash, it still took us nowhere near the highs of 2007. Now, from a
what does that say to you, Glenn?
Well, what it says to me is that on a long term,
it says the market goes up.
No. Listen.
It does.
But listen, okay? Because the once in 10 year crashes, when we get those big crashes that come along about every decade or so, they tend to take us down quite often to near the highs of the previous bull market would be, you know, a good kind of support level for a major crash. And even the 2020 crash took us nowhere near down to those levels. So what I'm saying is, even the 2021, sharp as it was still a bit of a blip in this long bull market that's lasted since 2009 that will end at some point.
And
when it ends, it'll probably take us way below March 2020's levels.
Yeah, but you're looking at the S&P, right? It was probably the best performing index of all.
Let's look at something else.
If you look at the FTSE or something, it's nowhere near
the FTSE.
Or the FTSE 250, domestic stock. Yeah, well, no, I know, but you're looking at the most overvalued indices, the most high-flying indices, that and the Nasdaq is then the best of all indices.
So, all right, FTSE. FTSE's depressing, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know, we're only just higher than where we were in 2007. Now we're only slightly higher.
I'm not talking about indices. I'm pretty much talking about looking at individual businesses, not you know, indices, businesses.
I know, but you well know that, as I do, that when
don't say well know because I don't.
You well know that when the FTSE has the big one, you know, when the whenever the next big crash is, it will drag down everything in AIM with it because it always does.
Yeah. But that's the time to buy a good company, good business. I'm looking at business, yeah, not share
that,
prices.
But, yeah, sure. After that has happened, would be a good time to buy. But what I'm saying is the various dips that we've had in recent times are not really proper dips. They're just kind of minor dips. So,
well, not,
you know,
on
when
individual
the big
companies
crash
they
comes
are.
Along, it will probably take us way below those levels
dips. You live in that fear. And because you live in that fear,
I'm never living in fear.
You do. You completely always traders
no
always
fear.
What about when the world explodes? What are you going to do then with your money? Eh? You're not investing in the market after that. Hang on. Let me ask you a question here, right?
I'm not talking about the world exploding. I'm talking about the regular, fairly predictable events.
Let me ask you a question.
Once a decade when the market crashes. It's not like you don't have to be
a genius or
a pessimist to work that one out because it happens every 10 years or so.
Let me ask you a question, okay? Every big crash we've had, it's been the end of the world. But the stock markets end up going higher, right?
Yeah,
now, what do you expect to...
Why don't you just take my point?
And
I'm just saying...
Let me finish.
Go on.
Now, barring aliens coming down and obliterating the Earth, right?
Right.
What do you think the next big thing is going to be then? Because we've had the banks, the financial system crashing completely, pretty much. That nearly took everything down. Now, that's the very lubricant of everything that we deal with in monetary terms. That nearly happened. That's all right. Stock market's gone high since then. We've had a pandemic that shut down the entire economy of the world. Okay? That's happened. We had the dot-com boom where people are just chucking money ridiculously at this new sector, which, of course, is massive now, but at the time popped like crazy. That happens, right? Go back even further. You've had world wars. You've had all kinds of things. How bad do you think it's going to get then, Glenn? What are you looking for?
You know the catastrophe. We've talked about it.
No, you don't. In your head, it's the human psyche. You fear the unknown.
Listen, the unknown.
The unknown is never as bad as the reality.
I'm talking about the inflationary threat, right? It's not a story.
Oh, buy Bitcoin then. Buy Bitcoin. Buy Bitcoin.
No, well, funny you say that because we were going to mention
there,
how Bitcoin has actually fallen while inflation figures are rising. It's not happened straight away, is it? To that myth that Bitcoin is.
No, it's not happened straight away, is it? We got short term selling pressure in Bitcoin, but as a deflationary asset, it's probably quite good as an insulator. You know,
yeah.
I mean, you know, it's not gonna, as soon as inflation figures come out, Bitcoin's going to rally like crazy, as if we didn't know that.
I'm not convinced. The one thing that you can rely on to protect you against inflation / interest rate rises to some degree is gold. The correlation between the price of gold and the inflation adjusted interest rate is, in other words, the real interest rate. The correlation between gold and the real interest rate is rock solid and has been for many, many years. So, you know, what I'm saying is if inflation is higher than interest rates and is continuing to get higher and higher in relation to interest rates, which are being artificially held down, then gold is your play. Bitcoin could also be a good play, but as we've seen, it's unproven. Sometimes it does the thing you don't expect it to do with regard to sort of inflation and interest rates, and that's worrying. It's not the correlation.
Don't worry,
is not
Glenn. You worry too much. You worry too much. I think that's the trouble.
I'm just doing my job, warning people that Bitcoin might not be everything that some people seem to think it is. It might be, but it's unproven. It's too young for us to know for sure if it's going to be a good inflation hedge.
There's always bears online, right? They worry about everything. Inflation, the Fed,
the debt, non-stop, the debt is rising, and it's rising. But you've got to admit, even you have to admit that now debt levels are just insanely high. Money printing is insanely high.
Right.
That's
the problem with
inflation
that?
Is rising. What's wrong with that? You know, it's heading for a fall. But as you quite rightly point out, people have been saying that for a long, long time. And so I do take it with a bit of a pinch of salt, because particularly after 2008, 2009, when the money printing started, every wise old investor who with a right wing sort of libertarian bent was saying, we're going to have the collapse of the economy now and hyperinflation because of this money printing. And it didn't happen. Is it different this time? I think to some degree it is different this time. The economy is expanding
to
fast.
Some degree.
To some degree, yeah, because we can't.
It's not the end of the
sure.
world, though. It's not the end of the
well,
world.
It might be the end See? Of the financial
and
world.
And that's it. Do you know what?
The remaking of the financial
course,
world. It might.
It's a fear of the unknown in the future. We know that, but
collapse of the dollar and all that.
Listen, I mean, it's catastrophizing.
If you read
any long-term successful investor, right, and they'll say to you, do you know what? Don't pay too much money. Serious mind to the naysayers about the Fed and the interest rates and inflation over time. They'll always be there, but the stock markets will always do quite well.
That's true. That's why I'm heavily invested in stocks. I absolutely agree with that. Which is, you know, I take the inflation dollar destruction theory very seriously, but at the same time I take it with a pinch of salt because it's by no means a foregone conclusion. And in the meantime, as you quite rightly point out, I can't really afford not to be invested in the stock market because we don't know how high it will go. It could go a lot higher than this, and as a result I want to be invested until I see serious signs that things are going awry, and then I will be out of there, boy. I will be out of there because I don't want to sit through a once in a decade crash. I'll sit through the minor corrections, but not something on that scale.
Right, we've got a hard fork here at 11 o'clock. So what's next on the agenda?
Right, okay. What else have I got for you? Well, we've got the Met Police seizing £180 million of cryptocurrency, though they didn't say it was Bitcoin. It could be other cryptocurrencies, maybe one of the mysterious private ones like Monero, but Monero is much, much harder to track. So I guess it's more likely that it was Bitcoin. See, they love doing this, the police. We've talked about this before, because they can confiscate huge amounts of Bitcoin, which actually, in many cases, are not that difficult to track down because of course, the Bitcoin sits on a public blockchain, one that the police can look at, one that I can look at. We can trace and watch payments going from one Bitcoin wallet to another Bitcoin wallet to another Bitcoin wallet. And there are clues that are sort of thrown up sometimes along the way that help the police to connect these Bitcoin wallets to real world people's identities, or sometimes they just get tip-offs that help them do that. I mean, in this case, we don't know. They might have even, you know, gone to the person's house and just said, give us your wallet password. It could have been as simple as that, and then they seized the money that way. There are all kinds of ways, but actually, as the Deputy Assistant Commissioner Graham McNulty said, proceeds of crime are laundered in many different ways. Cash still remains king in the criminal world. And he's right. And of course, it remains king for a very good reason, which is that it can't be traced. You can't trace a suitcase full of banknotes moving, you know, around the country in someone's car, whereas you can trace Bitcoin moving from wallet to wallet. So cash is still, you know, if I were a crim, I'd still be using cash. I wouldn't be using crypto.
So really, we're saying that it's a good thing these criminals are messing around with crypto because they're more traceable, aren't they? You know?
Exactly. They might think they're clever, but they're not feeling so clever when 180 million... pounds worth of crypto is seized. One more story worth mentioning, seeing as we've got 2 minutes. There is a nuclear-powered crypto mining facility opening. A US power company plans on building a 300-megawatt crypto mining facility and data center right next to its nuclear nuclear power plant in Pennsylvania. So over there in America, you might have heard, I'm sure you, well, in fact, we talked about it last week, how China is closing down loads of its crypto miners' operations, stopping them from mining crypto. So crypto is moving to other parts of the world now, the mining part of it, the creation part of it. And as we know, it uses a lot of electricity. So it makes sense to use renewable sources when they're available and when they're cheap. And citing the mining facility, which is basically a big warehouse full of computers, sticking it next to a nuclear power station makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So it will evolve. I mean, people have been, you know, hammering Bitcoin for the... I know it uses a lot of energy and we're trying to, you know, generate energy through clean alternative means. But like I said, it'll evolve. We'll get to the stage where now, you know, like anything, you know, sustainable energy. You know, people don't use sustainable energy to mine Bitcoin. We'll be like, no, you mustn't do that. You know, there'll be peer pressure and all that stuff.
There is huge peer pressure from the institutions who invest in Bitcoin.
It'll sort itself out. Marvellous, Glenn. Thanks for that. And I'm still holding a little bit of Ethereum, Cardano and Bitcoin. Not a lot, just to keep my eye in.
Oh, you watching. Cheeky thing.
Yeah, just keep watching it. Otherwise, I just forget about it, you know? So I just got a little bit in there. Just
yeah, good idea.
Keep my eye on the ball. Lovely. Thanks for that, Glenn. Speak to you next week.
Okay, bye.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, E-Energy. Non-mover, 20.5. At four, it's Mobile Streams, down 4%, 2.4, I should say. At three, Source Bio, non-mover, 150. At two, Pool Big Pharma. That's a new spin-off, of course, from Open Orphan. People are following that. And at one, Equals Group. Again, non-mover. The market's hard today. It's non-mover at 46 pence. Okay, top five most read RNSs are as follows. At five, Open Orphan, COVID-19 Human Challenge Program update. At four, Open Orphan, new contract win for Open Orphan's breeder office. At three, Bushveld Minerals, announcement on litigation. At two, Open Orphan, director's dealings, of course. Cahill talked about that. And at one, Avacta, diagnostics achieves ISO 13485 certification. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
You have five new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.